Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben. Today, my guests are Anne Blair and Caspar von Greyerts. Anne and Caspar are the editors of this new book, Physical Theology, Religion and Science in Europe, 1650 to 1750, just published at the end of last year, 2020, by the John Hopkins University Press. Anne and Caspar, thank you for your time today, and it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Before we begin talking about the book itself, Physical Theology, Religion and Science in Europe, 1650 to 1750, Anne and Caspar, could you tell us something about your background at Harvard, Anne, at Basel, Caspar, and some of your previous publications that have led you up to this project that you've collaborated on?
So I've been a historian of early modern European history with an emphasis on intellectual history, history of science. And I think I got into science and religion by studying Jean Bodin, who wrote a natural philosophy in the late 16th century, which was trying to overturn the established parameters of natural philosophy based on Aristotle and instead be properly pious and bring people to a better attitude toward God and use the Bible as a source of answers about the natural philosophical world. So that got me teaching in science and religion, and I taught for a number of years, a very long, skinny course, as I thought of it, from Augustine to creationism, on the interactions between science and religion. And so this book is part of that aspect of what I've been doing for about 20 years as an academic. But I've got other interests, too, which we can talk about later, in book history, for example, and the history of education and working methods of intellectuals and writers.
Great. And Caspar?
I'm originally a Reformation historian, one of the few people still active in the field who've actually studied RenRef, the RenRef program at Stanford at the time. And I've gradually sort of moved to up into the 17th and 18th centuries. And I got interested in physical theology because of the very narrow connection between religion and science. I first addressed the issue of science in a volume that got translated from the German into French and English on religion and culture in early modern Europe. And this is sort of follows up on the thoughts, this volume now, on the thoughts I developed at the time. I did some editing, if I may just briefly go into that, some editing in the field, but these things have mostly been published in German. That was 2010 on religion and science in the 16th and 17th centuries, a collected volume, and another one published in 2013, which is actually mixed German and English on connecting science and knowledge. But nothing yet in terms of the comprehensiveness of what Anne and I have done together.
Now, that's fascinating, Casper, that you mention this book as, or you describe this book as a comprehensive project, and it certainly is, isn't mm-hmm. it? It's really the first attempt, the first big project to put together a comprehensive history of physical theology in this period, which is one of the reasons why it's such an exciting volume to read and indeed to talk about today. Now, you describe in the preface and acknowledgements to this volume that it has emerged out of a scholarly conference in Wolfenbüttel back in, I think, 2017, if I remember correctly.
Exactly. Exactly. Wolfenbüttel is the big the library in Wolfenbüttel, the big center of early modern research in Germany these days. There's no other German library that actually parallels its quality and the quality also of its holdings. And they do run conferences. I actually ran a conference there almost 40 years ago in 1982, when they were still sort of getting off the ground as an organization. And it's always it's a pleasant atmosphere. It's well organized, so that's why we were able to do it there, also because of they funded a part of the conference, and the rest was done by the Fritz Thyssen Stiftung, big German foundation, and actually helped us to get this off the ground.
I think it was really a wonderful opportunity to bring people together across different national contexts, and that's reflected in the volume as well, where basically half of the authors are, you know, native speakers of English and writing often from the English context or from American academic context, but the other half are from German and French and Italian and Swiss institutions and historiographies. And it was a wonderful opportunity for us all to meet. Sometimes these were, you know, people whose works we'd read but never had been able to meet them in person. And to talk. And of course, there's a lot of a spillover between the formal conference and the informal opportunities to mingle, which sadly we are not enjoying at this time. So it was a lovely occasion and a great location. And Wolfenbüttel actually digitizes a fair number of their collections. So the Herzog August Bibliothek, which means Duke August Library, founded by this 17th century Duke of Brunswick, is a fantastic resource with a specialism in 17th century holdings.
Fantastic. And their website, of course, offers all kinds of fellowship opportunities and so on. If people are interested, they can find out some more. Now, it is fascinating to see how a book that comes out of a symposium nevertheless manages to hold on to some of the sparkle and fizz that so often that as academics we enjoy at these events. And I thought one of the really striking features of the book is the way that the chapters speak to each other. There's a real sense in this volume that we're being invited into a conversation. And it's a very lively conversation, isn't it? Not everyone agrees about everything. There are different perspectives about how to read individual authors or publications. And it's a lot of fun. It really is. So as we think about this volume, Physical Theology, Religion and Science in Europe, 1650 to 1750, as a groundbreaking volume in its field, could you tell us about why that is so? What has been the long discussion of religion and science in early modern Europe? And how does it settle down at the present day?
So I think early modern science has, and science and religion has taken a number of routes. One of the routes has been, of course, the Catholic context and the idea of the Galileo affair, that there was a conflict. It was, I think, due to many contingent factors, but nevertheless, once the conflict is there, it creates a narrative of a necessary or inevitable conflict between science and religion. And the other side is much more a conciliatory one, showing how science and religion have favored one another. And this story can start being told in the Middle Ages, when the Catholic Church was, of course, one of the sites for funding, research and writing about the natural world. And after the Reformation, it's often also in Protestant environments, there's a fair amount of synergy between science and religion. And in particular, the project called Natural Theology, the idea that by studying nature on its own terms, in rational terms, you actually come to understand God, divine creation, the laws of nature, which are all beautifully arranged and providential in yielding a world which is generally assessed rather positively in this mode of thinking. So I think natural theology, of course, also has roots even prior to Christianity. You can see ancient thinkers talking about a system of nature that self-perpetuates and self-regulates. Cicero, for example, has some of these themes. But of course, the Christian overlay emphasizes the divine planning and sustenance of this admirable natural world. So I think that's the probably the dominant mode in which our book inserts itself. But we like to emphasize what's a subset of natural theology, which hasn't gotten much attention for its peculiarities, which is what the people at the time, and we use in our title and throughout the book, the term physico-theology, hyphenated.
Well, I think it has to, the fact that this has been neglected by research to date has a lot to do with the fact that Anglo-American research much stronger and much more present internationally than German-speaking research in this field. It has very often just treated physico-theology and natural theology as synonyms. And that meant that you had historians speaking about physical theology at ancient times, etc., etc. And what we're really trying to do with this conference was to establish for the first time, really, in an English volume, that there are very distinct features to this phenomenon, which sort of make it, even though it stays part of natural theology, make it a very distinct phenomenon. I think one of the, if I may go into that, and will I'm sure we'll add other points. One of the interesting things is, for example, that all of physical theologians, actually argue mechanistically. And that's an indication that this tradition or movement only really started in the mid-17th century, because before, in older natural theology, nobody was arguing mechanistically. It was a takeover from Descartes. Of course, you know, Descartes is hotly disputed at the time, and also is seen with negative connotations in many quarters, but that's probably one of the basic ideas of his work, which was adopted all over the place. We haven't made that much of it in our introduction because other people outside physical theology argued in the same way, but in terms of sort of saying. Of claiming that this started in the mid-17th century, it's important to point to this to mechanism.
So that's a fascinating observation, Casper. I suppose it's a very important point to hammer home to the reader as well, isn't it? That physical theology is not a synonym of natural theology, but it's a kind of a genre of discussion that sits within natural theology at a particular moment in the history of that long Christian and indeed non-Christian discussion. Could you tell us something more about the relationship between natural theology and physical theology?
One of the points of the book is to emphasize that natural theology and physical theology have typically been reduced to the argument from design, the idea that the world is well arranged as we can see, and therefore there must be a creator and a providential creator. And that's definitely a very important theme. But there are also many other themes running. And in particular, physical theology doesn't just admire the laws, but it can also admire the wondrous, the surprises. And so it's an awe as well as an admiration of the mechanisms of nature. And another element of physical theology is reconciling the Bible, often quite taken quite, literally, seriously in its details, with the science. And so a lot of attention to the flood, for example, and how do we match biblical descriptions with observations from this new science, which Caspar was mentioning, which is the science of Newton and Hooke and Boyle and all these people, Swammerdam and Leeuwenhoek and all these people who were using microscopes and telescopes and recording their observations and being very empirical about it. And yet the mindset in which they do this is principally to advance a religious project or to reconcile science with religion constantly through connections with the biblical text and or basically talking about divine omnipotence, divine providence, divine wisdom and benevolence. So it's a subset. There are also even some features of physical theology which we weren't able to find experts to write on, basically a physical theology of resurrection and so forth, which are rather really taking some serious theological elements and trying to fit them into the new science mold to really reconcile every element. One thing that I find so remarkable, this term physico-theology is used at the time, but not just that. They talk about bronto-theology, the theology of lightning, and rana-theology, the theology of frogs, and our cover shows this kind of emphasis on specific species, and the frog in particular. And you can do this indefinitely. You can take any piece of nature, and the more you delve into it, and the more empirically you look at it with microscopes, etc., the more you will find demonstration of the greatness of God. In many ways, because of the wonder it causes, because of the laws that it shows. So both the regularities and the irregularities and the correspondence with the Bible are all these multi-pronged ways of performing this reconciliation that they're really interested in.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I was really struck in the book by the way that a number of contributors called attention to the possible limitations of physical theology as a way of doing theology, because it speaks to certain parts of the divine being, certain attributes, power, you mentioned omnipotence and so forth, but not to others. And so, you know, while, as your contributors demonstrate, there might be some excellent discussions of parthenogenesis or you know, virgin birth theories, it's a theology that experiences some more difficulties when it comes to speak about suffering or natural disasters, isn't it?
Yes, but that's because one of the other elements in physical theology that distinguishes it from preceding forms of natural theology is a completely new image of God. It's not the God of Thomas Beard's The Theatre of God's Judgments, published in the late 16th century, and actually typically having its last fourth or so edition in 1648, just before the period of physical theology actually started. It's not that kind of image of God, the irascible God God, the unpredictable God of the late 16th and early 17th century. But they all make it a point to highlight his goodness, and his goodness means also, in a sense, his predictability. And actually, the study of nature, the idea behind it is that the study of nature will help to find out more about his intentions.
So empirical scientists want a predictable God. It's a fascinating combination, isn't it? That drives so much of this discussion. Well, you mentioned earlier on that around about half of the contributors to this volume are from non-Anglophone intellectual traditions. And obviously that that maps onto the geographical breadth of interest in physical theology in the later 17th, 18th, and even, you suggest, into the 19th century as well, or your contributor suggests, into the 19th century as well. Where does physical theology first emerge as a specific discussion, and where does it last longest?
Well, that's a tricky question. As you know, even the authors within the book don't completely agree. But
I want to see if the editors do.
But clearly the English world, John Ray and William Durham, you know, have classically been identified as some of the first who self-identify as physical theologians. But the Dutch world is very important. The German, in addition. And then by the 18th century, we have some major Swiss figures like Johann Jakob Schweitzer. So it is one thing to say is it's traditionally been a very Protestant milieu. But I'm really pleased that in the book we also look at a couple Catholic contexts and the complexity of the confessional environment is such, as Caspar was saying, this view of a God who's admirable because he's predictable is actually cross-confessional. And in particular, we talk about, there's a nice article on Blaise Pascal, who himself was quite hostile to the natural theological project, and yet who's interpreted by the Jansenists, who basically publish from his unpublished material, his Pensée, they're much more favorable to the natural theological project. So in a way, they distort his views by channeling them in a certain way and omitting, fragments that don't fit a natural theological perspective. And the other big Catholic figure in the book is the Abbé Antoine Pluche, who is also Jansenist leaning, although at a time when you couldn't be Jansenist explicitly, who spends a lot of time really, in a way, diffusing and popularizing the findings of the new science to a broad French-speaking audience with lots of lovely pictures, and who does want to reserve the limits of reason and remind you also that God is mysterious, even while, of course, he spends most of the time showing you how God is great in all these ways that we can observe. So it's a very rich confessional story.
One other a Catholic we should mention, even though he wasn't a physical theologian, was Antonio Vallisneri, a famous, at the time famous, professor of medicine at Padua, but who was in exchange with important physical theologians. Johann Jakob Schweitzer in Zurich was one of his correspondents, Louis Bourget in French-speaking Switzerland, Leibniz was one of his correspondents, and of course a whole array of Italians. And yet, in the end, he decided not to go, even though he was in touch with all these people who favored a physico-theological approach. He decided against it. And it's actually indicative of the Italian situation. In France, you have a number. I have counted in the meantime four, physico-theological authors, three in France, three of them are Jansenists. Only Pierre is probably just a regular, in quotation marks, a regular Catholic. And in Italy, we only have very, very few, even though there is a strong reception of Newtonianism, especially of the optics of Newton, not so much his astronomy, at least not officially, because discussing his astronomy could get you into difficulties with censure. But his optics are discussed intensively in the early 18th century. And yet there's only one Italian Newtonian who can perhaps be regarded to be a physico-theologian. That's Celestino Galiani, and who was the abbot of the Order of the Celestines. That's why his first that explains his first name. I'm not sure about that at all. And the others are two, a father and son, Monti, Giovanni Monti and Gaetano Monti at the Academy of Bologna. And that's it. So even less than in France, that really makes it a predominantly Protestant phenomenon.
Fascinating. Maybe you could tell us something about the German context as well. I was very struck, we've been talking about Jansenists, I was very struck by the contrast between the Jansenist Augustinian tradition that comes into Jansenism with the Augustinian tradition mm-hmm. that comes into Lutheranism. And of course, as your contributors show, they have very different views of the possibilities of physical theology, don't they?
Well, absolutely. I think, well, this has been conceived, German physical theology very broadly in a historiographical tradition in Germany. But I think one has to exclude the Orthodox Lutherans, for example. They really can't, they have made no contribution to physical theology at all, because their insistence on the Augustinian limitations of human cognition is just too prevalent. But there is a very early, which we point to in our introduction, an early Latin tradition in Germany, which starts in the 1670s, but it's and eventually turns into vernacular literature at the turn of the century. We don't know exactly what triggered this Latin phase. It begins with dissertation chaired by Johann Christoph Sturm at Altdorf. Altdorf was a small university just outside of Nuremberg, and on the eye that sees God. In fact, not with physical theology in the title yet, but I think that's a general difference between the continent and the English situation. The English start writing treatises which almost always actually have physical theology in the title, whereas in Germany and also in the Dutch literature, that doesn't, there is a difference. In Germany, actually, these Brontë theology and Rana theology, etc., they're a phenomenon of the 18th century only. But all the treatises written before, don't declare themselves to be explicitly to be physical theology. And in Holland, the same thing. The notion of physical theology doesn't exist, even though there's a whole number, starting with Jan Swammerdam in the late 17th century, a whole number of physical theological authors that just don't call it that.
Physical theology gives us a great example of the diffusion of these books through translation. So the decline of Latin is happening at the same time, and they are operating mainly in the vernacular, and they're translating works from one language to another, which is something I think we don't get into as much as I would have liked. It's a new project for the future to talk yes. about the role of translation in diffusing and, of course, transforming to some extent. You know, the choice of title, for example, and just emphases can be modified in a translation. And of course, the whole point of translating is because printers are going to make money from selling these books. And so there is a sense of finding out what people want to read through what printers think they're going to want to buy, which is what they care about. And many of these books do go through multiple editions, which is a sign of success in selling. So it's a very rich field. And then the other area I think we could study more is marginal annotations in the surviving copies of books as people, readers, individual readers with pen in hand, respond to the text. And that we could, there's lots of opportunity, thanks to digitization in particular, that many of these early printed books, you know, they're all out of copyright, obviously, and many of them have been digitized and are freely available from a lot of different, there's a giant German and other Swiss projects to digitize books in bulk. And you can actually look at multiple copies of the same book too and watch, you know, maybe find the annotations of someone, maybe you won't know who, but that are just survived because the book was digitized.
And you can actually also compare translations and the original these days online, which sometimes gets interesting results when physical theologians are translators. They sort of try to adapt what they're translating, Fenelon, for example, to their own needs. And the most curious example about translations I know are a couple of treatises by Robert Boyle. They get translated into Latin in Geneva, and pirated, of course. There's no because Henry Oldenburg, on behalf of Boyle, actually complains about this in the Philosophical Transactions. And what happens is that the Pietists in Germany, in Halle, actually use these Latin versions, which the Genevans pirated, to produce the German version of Robert Boyle's treatises. So sometimes you have complicated processes. But I looked at that, and actually the Latin translations plus the German versions are very much to the original.
Well,
but that's always the case.
Anne Casper, Anne Blair and Casper von Greyerz, it's been wonderful to talk to you today, a lively conversation, which really speaks to the fun as well as the intellectual seriousness of the book that we're discussing today, Physical Theology, Religion and Science in Europe, 1650 to 1750, just published by the John Hopkins University Press. Thank you both so much for your time today. Very much appreciate it. Could you tell us what you're working on next?
Well, my project, long underway, is on the hidden helpers of intellectual work in early modern Europe. So when you write a book as a physical theologian, who else is actually helping you out in the background, maybe taking notes for you, copying things? Of course, everything is being done by hand, and there's a lot of making of clean copies, correcting proofs, and all those things. So the category term I'm using is amanuensis. That is the hand helpers. You can see from the term aman, from the hand. And it is a complicated project because these helpers are scattered all over Europe. Most recently, so that one is going to take a little patience still, but I just have co-edited with three other colleagues interesting book called Information, a Historical Companion, which has a couple of units on secretaries and helpers, but many other features of how information is created, disseminated, and then used and consumed. So I think that's a promising new way of framing the history of knowledge.
Great.
I have a couple of projects, but I only want to mention the one on locusts, because I ran, when I worked on physical theology for a monograph, which is currently actually being looked at by an English publisher, and hopefully they will take it. when I did this research, I ran into these treatises dealing with locust invasions in 1693 in Central Europe, and then again in 1747, 1748. And in 1693, these locusts actually got as far as North Wales.
That's right.
And there was a conversation there between people in North Wales and Edward Lewitt at Oxford, because they didn't exactly know what these creatures, because they were much bigger than their local grasshoppers. They didn't exactly know what these kind of creatures were. So I want to go into that. I left that out of the book I've just completed, and I want to go. I want to get back to that and look into it. It's fun in many ways, because these armies of locusts, of millions probably of locusts, descending on Transylvania and Germany at the time in 1693. They were very much described in terms of reporting on the Turkish wars, and that really makes for amusing reading at points. It's a much neglected phenomenon. Nobody really has known about that.
But it's also a very sad one. I'm sure lots of devastation was.
Oh, absolutely.
Was wrought by them, and that's how. Crawford, you pointed out the difficulty of physical theology is that it is an optimistic spin on things, and it sometimes gets to a tight spot when reality is quite grim.
Exactly. Physical theologians dealing with that devastation actually only laconically could say, well, at least the good Lord has made sure that we can, after they've eaten up our harvest, that we can eat them. But that's, of course, you know, little consolation.
Yes, that's optimism in the nth degree, isn't it? Well, Anne Blair and Caspar von Greyerz, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. And thank you for editing this volume, so beautifully produced by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Thank you for your time and take care.
Thank you. Goodbye.
And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.